GreenSense is brought to you by JLT Specialty USA, the world's largest energy insurance broker, serving the entire energy continuum. Visit JLTUS.com.
Welcome to GreenSense, a weekly look at the people, policies, and innovations that are changing our world. Here's Robert Colangelo.
Welcome. That's me, scientist, author, and environmental entrepreneur, and I'm the host for today's show.
I'm Bob Kessler, our executive producer.
Bob and I explore environmental issues and innovations, and we get to meet the passionate people that are changing our world with their innovative ideas.
Investing in green seems to be making more and more economic sense. I mean, look at this boom in the sale of green bonds, something like $150 billion this year, predicted twice what it was last year. So we'll find out how green bonds might save the planet. And if you do have to throw stuff in the trash, you know, it makes sense if those trash bags are made sustainably. So we'll meet an inventor.
Green bonds and sustainable trash bags, all coming up on this week's edition of GreenSense. Green automotive news is how we'll kick off this GreenSense programming. Joining us is Tom Appel, publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. Tom, it's always good to talk to you. You constantly amaze us with your in-depth knowledge. So today we're going to talk about Project Portal, and you're going to have to go slow here because this is a little confusing to me. So tell me what Toyota is doing with Project Portal.
Yeah, Toyota is probably the manufacturer, the automotive manufacturer, with the most, or at least tied with Honda, one of the most expertise in the area of fuel cells. And Project Portal is the application of fuel cells for over-the-road trucks. Anyone who's talked to me about green technology knows that I'm slightly skeptical of fuel cell technology. I think it's complicated and expensive and space-consuming for automobiles. But I see the application here, and I'm actually kind of excited. I think that what we've reached now is a point where there's some clarity about the future of transportation and green fuel. Where cars are probably going to go electric, fuel cells offer a number of benefits for over-the-road trucking that are probably necessary because battery power won't do it alone.
So let's get into the details. Would this be a hydrogen-powered fuel cell?
Yep, that's exactly what it would be. And if you think about why, this makes a lot of sense. If we look at the Tesla Model S, a very popular application of the electric car, the car weighs about 5,000 pounds and has a 1,400-pound battery. If we took that out to a semi-truck, which has a fully loaded weight of about 80,000 pounds, a battery to do the exact same amount of work would weigh 25,000 pounds, which is completely unacceptable. And this is why hydrogen power makes so much sense for big trucks. You can reduce the weight, and there's the space for the fuel cells, which there really isn't in cars. A fuel cell, a hydrogen tank has to be round and cylindrical because it's so high pressure. That makes packaging very difficult in an automobile. But on a truck, in the area behind the cab where there's usually a sleeper, you can fill that with hydrogen all day long and really extend the range of that vehicle.
Well, let's talk about that. Hydrogen can be quite explosive if there was a crash, and if you have a big truck with a big amount of hydrogen, does that create some kind of a safety hazard?
That question gets asked a lot. I've asked that of a number of people in the industry. They say it's no more dangerous to handle than gasoline or diesel. There is the perception that hydrogen is very dangerous, and it is. It needs to be kept under pressure, and obviously it needs to be kept away from extreme heat or from impact. But it's really not a lot more difficult in terms of safety to handle than gasoline or diesel fuel.
So, Tom, what's keeping this from happening?
Probably nothing. This is probably something we're going to see more of. Toyota is just beginning the research now. Facts are very limited, but I think it's very exciting. I think that the opportunity is here to make this work. Also, when you talk about infrastructure, there are truck stops all along the highway, and I think that equipping them specifically with hydrogen outlets is probably a more logical thing to do because you're going to find an audience coming directly to them. I think that makes a lot more sense than trying to put in hydrogen at every gas station corner in the U.S.
Let's talk about the economics. Why do the economics work here?
The economics work basically because if you think about an electric vehicle, you have 200-300 miles of range. We're talking about the more advanced vehicles that are coming online now. But then you have to stop. No matter what you do, you have to stop and recharge that. And that takes a considerable amount of time. In a case of an 80,000-pound semi-tractor trailer, that recharge time could be dramatic. And that's not something that's acceptable in transportation. Obviously, people fill up and they take off right away. They can't afford several hours of downtime to recharge a battery. And that's where the hydrogen thing would work. It takes no more time or little more time to fuel than it does with diesel. So you significantly less downtime.
Are you going to get more miles per charge? Not charge. How do you measure your miles?
Efficiency tends to be measured in miles per gallon equivalent, or MPGE. That's how the EPA likes to do it. Right now, we find that fuel cell vehicles have a comparable MPGE rating to gasoline-powered vehicles. So over-the-road trucks should probably return the same energy efficiency as diesel-powered trucks, or similar.
And we're going to get a lot less emissions.
Reduced emissions is a huge point, yes, because the emission of a fuel cell is basically water.
That's Consumer Guide Automotive Publisher Tom Appel with Green Automotive News. Check out this week's show notes for a link to what we've been talking about. Subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play when you visit greensensefarms.com. While we wish that everything could be recycled, some things have to be thrown in the trash. And if they are, it makes sense that those trash bags are made to be more sustainable. Evolution Trash Bags recently announced a line of eco-friendly trash bags, and we're joined by the company's president, Jim Seary. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Jim, give me the elevator speech. What makes your trash bag sustainable?
Sure. One of the key things or components makeup of our product is post-consumer recycled material. And post-consumer recycled material is product that was diverted from a landfill and converted into some other type of useful item. Our bag is made up of 70% post-consumer recycled content.
And let's talk about what is that post-consumer recycled content?
Currently, our post-consumer recycled content is film or tubing from irrigation and farms. So it's basically one of the most sustainable way of irrigating farm systems. And instead of having that product go to a landfill, we actually collect it after the farmers used it during the growing season. So currently we recycle about 100 million pounds of that annually and convert it into trash bags.
And Jim, how are typical trash bags made?
Typical trash bags are made out of a product called virgin resin. And virgin resin is either produced from natural gas or oil and then converted into resin.
Let's dig a little deeper into this and talk about a life cycle analysis of your bags versus traditional bags. Have you done one of those?
We have done it. Primarily, we have several facts with regards to our LCA, and 37% lower global climate change emissions, 31% less impact on ocean warming, and a 50% decrease in human exposure. Our LCA is conducted on basically 100,000 traditional trash bags, meaning the major brands, which utilize virgin resin, versus our product, which uses 70% recycled content or post-consumer recycled content. So basically, it's a cradle-to-grave analysis, meaning that the actual drills or drilling of the oil and converting it into resin versus ours, which is basically 70% resin already created.
Well, that's pretty fantastic results. Most people don't think about what trash bags they buy. How do you set yourselves apart, and how do you get the consumer to really care about the trash bags that their trash goes into?
It's a really difficult thing. You know, one of the things my kids always say, Dad, you're not going to bring up. Please don't bring up trash bags. Please don't bring up trash bags. But I'm like, guys, you want to go to college? I got to bring up trash bags. And we look at the industry. The industry is roughly $80 to $120 billion industry. It's significant. And there's 150 million households in this country. If everyone converted over to using post-consumer recycled content, the environment would be significantly better due to that LCA study. You're looking at virgin resin versus post-consumer recycled resin, and it is just by far a more sustainable way of dealing with trash bags. No one likes trash bags. It's just because it has that nasty name of plastic. But at the end of the day, if we shop in a grocery store, you're not going to be able to compost or recycle everything that comes out of that grocery store.
So how do you differentiate yourself, and how do you make the consumer care?
Well, we differentiate ourselves by really diverting product from a landfill. Evolution Bags, again, contributes to diverting 100 million pounds of plastic from landfills. And one of the key things I really want to do is educate the consumer. For instance, biodegradable. There are no such thing as biodegradable plastics in an anaerobic landfill. But you'll see so many claims out there with consumer goods of biodegradable plastics, biodegradable. Now you even see biodegradable sandals, biodegradable shoes. Once something goes into a landfill, absolutely nothing biodegrades. And that includes paper. So a lot of folks will sit there and say, well, why not use paper bags? Paper bags are fantastic. If they were to get out of the landfill and float around the environment, they will 100% biodegrade and eventually turn to nothing. But plastic, once it's in a landfill, nothing happens to it. The same with paper. Once paper's in a landfill, nothing biodegrades.
So you're keeping fresh, virgin, petroleum-based feedstock from going into a landfill.
That's correct. And also the energy savings, the greenhouse gas emissions from getting virgin resin from either natural gas or oil, as opposed to the post-consumer recycled content, which is basically taking product that already exists, breaking it down, and turning it into something new.
What's the biggest lesson you learned as a green entrepreneur?
One of the biggest lessons I've learned so far is really from an education standpoint. It really is key to go out and do your research. Everything we have at Evolution Trash Bags is third-party certified. In other words, I can make all the claims I want with regards to how green my product is, but we have the EPA that we meet EPA compliance, which is 10%. The EPA thinks that post-consumer recycled material is so important that they have a mandate to be green and EPA compliant. It has to have a minimum of 10% post-consumer recycled content. We have 70% post-consumer recycled content. And also we have UL Eco Logo, which is a third-party certification company that comes in and says we do everything that we say we do, meaning that we meet a minimum standard of 20% post-consumer recycled content. So what I've found out, though, there's so many greenwashing as far as marketers, and there is absolutely nothing to back up their claim. The state of California and the state of Maryland recently banned the use of biodegradable terms in their marketing. That's how important they think it is, because there's so much of the public believe that biodegradable plastics actually exist, when in fact it doesn't unless it's compostable.
That's Jim Seary, Evolution Trash Bags president, here on Green Sense.
This is Bob Kessler, executive producer of Green Sense Radio. Every week, we cover environmental issues and meet passionate people and sustainable innovators. You might have noticed we do it with very few commercials. Our advertisers, they're just part of what supports Green Sense. We need the help of our listeners, also passionate people who care about the planet and know the value of independent media, which matters now more than ever. We've just launched our fundraising drive, so you can help us continue to bring you informative and inspiring shows. Your contributions will cover our small production staff, which seeks out and schedules interviews, edits them, and puts together Green Sense every week. Plus, there's the cost of online hosting and studio equipment. So when you visit greensensefarms.com, click on Radio Show to make a contribution via Podbean. It takes just a few minutes, and as we often say on the program, individual actions multiplied by millions can yield big results. So if you're inspired by our positive and informative shows, we're asking you to help keep Green Sense going. Visit greensensefarms.com and click Radio Show to contribute to our fundraising drive via Podbean. On behalf of all of us at Green Sense Radio, thank you.
Green bonds saw massive growth in 2016, and 2017 is predicted to be even bigger. Sean Kidney is co-founder and CEO of the nonprofit Climate Bonds Initiative and serves as a member of the European Commission's high-level expert group on sustainable finance. And he's calling in from a restaurant in Bangkok. Sean, welcome to Green Sense.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, what's for dinner?
I'm having a Thai beef salad, and it's hot, I can tell you.
Well, I could see the sweat on your brow all the way on this side of the radio. Well, we'll get into the numbers in a moment, but for those who are financially impaired, Sean, define a traditional bond and how a green bond is different.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, a bond is just a formularized type of loan. You make a loan to someone, you promise to pay it back in X years, and you promise a certain interest rate. That's essentially it. A bond has got the advantage is you give them a bit of paper or an electronic equivalent nowadays, and that becomes tradable. So you can then sell that to someone else, pass it on, if you decide that you want to get your interest or as much as you can interest today. And the next person buys it at a slight discount, makes a bit of money on it, and so on. So you get a tradable market, which is incredibly handy for pension funds and insurance funds, because they've always got to have the ability to cash in their loans and their debts, because, you know, if your great uncle dies and there's a big payout to the family as a result, they've got to be able to get the cash to make the payout. And so liquidity in loans becomes important, and bonds are perfect for that.
That was now, a great explanation.
as you can see, I have it in practice. The green part is just one of those loans where the money goes to green. So you're only allowed to use the money for something that qualifies as green. We'll talk a little bit about that in a minute, what that means. But like, you know, you might get a loan from a bank for your house, but they say, we'll give you the loan on the house. You're going to guarantee it, but you promise only to use it for the extra bedroom, because they think the extra bedroom is going to add value to the house or going to be good for the neighborhood or whatever the reason being. And you say, okay, cross my heart and hope to die.
Well, these numbers that you've provided are impressive. $81 billion, according to your own climate bonds initiative. You expect $150 billion this year. What's behind the popularity among investors for these green bonds?
You know, investors are really worried about climate change. The people who run most of our money in the world are pension funds and insurance funds, and they're kind of full of actuaries who look at 40-year risk and 50-year risk. And if you're trying to figure out how you might match your assets and liabilities 40 to 50 years out, and you read the science, essentially you break out into a cold sweat, because the science is really grim. Like, you know, it is unbelievably grim. If you were to look at what people are saying is the likely probability of life in 2050, now, like, let's say a 50 to 60% chance, you hear stories of somewhere between 2 and 6 meter sea level rising. That's, you know, 6 to 18 feet sea level rise as around the world. This is gargantuan. You talk about average temperature rises around the planet, according to the International Energy Agency, have been 4 and 6 degrees Celsius. And I can never remember what that works out in Fahrenheit, but let's just say it's bloody hot. And it's even higher over land because the ocean absorbs it. And then you get the failure of maize as a crop in the Americas. You get the desertification of big chunks of Africa. You get the collapse of water and because the monsoon keeps failing in India. And you think, whoa, what happens next? Well, you can kind of guess, right? Billions of people move, you get wars, you get disease. And frankly, most of the really qualified climate change scientists I speak to talk about a potential loss of about a quarter or a third of the world's population by the end of the century.
That's significant.
That's more than significant. That is catastrophic. And that's the word the CEO of the International Energy Agency says, the world's coordinated petroleum reserves. He says the current trajectory we're on is catastrophic. So, you know, the actuaries get worried too, because they read this and they think, hey, I'm not going to be able to have the money to pay that guy's pension or insurance fund in 40 years' time. What do I do? And along comes a green bond. Green bond is quite a handy little kickstart for a green market. The risk and the yield is basically comparable with the other stuff you buy. It's 80% investment grade. The bonds are safe as houses in the short term because they're guaranteed by banks, governments, and the like. The money, however, only goes towards climate change solutions. So when you buy one of these, you're getting a good short-term return and you're addressing a long-term risk.
Who makes the decision in where to invest these monies into green projects?
Essentially, it's about climate change 98% of the time. It's about trying to get advice about what is an investment that's relevant to climate change. So when the state of Massachusetts issues a big green bond and allocates the money to building a port for a wind farm manufacturing center in Massachusetts, that complies because wind, clean energy is one of the critical investments we have to make to try and avert climate change.
Sean, if we didn't have bonds, green bonds, how would those projects get funded?
Well, they might get funded by bank loans. They might get funded by government money, which is scarce nowadays. We've, you know, reached our debt ceilings everywhere. You know, they'll get funded by equity. The problem is there's kind of not enough bank lending because of recapitalization of banks and debt ceilings and all that sort of stuff, or equity, to be able to do what's got to be required. I mean, to make this transition to a low-carbon and climate-resilient economy in double-quick time, this is a bit like 1942 mobilization in the US-style time we've got to achieve, then we're going to need about $90 trillion between now and 2050. CapEx. Now, this is all capital investment that'll give us a return, right? This is solid investment. Most of it is sort of infrastructure-style investments like railways or energy. But it's a big CapEx lump up front because most of the stuff we have to do, big capital expenditure, low running cost, like a solar farm, unlike a coal-fired power station, lower capital expenditure but running cost along the way. So because of that CapEx burden, we've got to find a lot of capital up front and allocate it. Unless we get money out of the bond market to refinance all of those bank loans and those equities, we're sort of going to have a bit of a stuck swallowing the deal flow. So what we're trying to achieve is a situation where equity investors and bank lenders focus on getting new projects off the ground. And as soon as the project's up and running, bingo, sell it off to a pension fund. Either sell the whole project or sell the loans or refinance the bond market, which is the preferable thing to do because insurance funds offer 90% bonds. You know, you get a fund like Allianz, one of the world's, if not, I think it's the world's biggest insurance fund, 90% of investments are bonds. If we don't create bonds out of this, they aren't going to be able to invest and they aren't going to be able to hold these assets long term. So green bonds are the path to the solution.
I'm trying to figure out what role bonds play in financing projects. If you don't have projects that make a good, sound economic sense, they're hard to finance anyways. Is it the financeability of the project that makes it go forward, or will these bonds be a catalyst to make marginal green projects work?
If you can refinance in the bond market long term, you can get longer tenor, which means lock in an interest rate for the life of the asset. This is pretty valuable if you've got a 25-year long payback period, so you don't have fluctuating interest rates. Or you can refinance at much lower rates because interest rates in the bond market are at an unbelievable historic low globally in developed markets. So that raises that sort of reduces your lifetime cost of capital, makes the whole thing more efficient financially and more viable, exactly the word you were using. So that's step one, and that's really important. Because you've got so much demand for these kind of green bonds, because investors think this is it's a pretty cool thing to be able to not only get a reasonable return and save the planet at the same time. And I'm not only talking about big insurance funds, I'm talking about mom and pop investors like you and I are trying to get this sort of stuff too. Then you get a lot of demand, you shave a little bit off the cost of capital as a result of the strong demand, and that makes it even more viable. And then by creating a market where you've got evidence of investor demand, governments twig that, all I have to do is provide a little bit of guarantee here or some regulatory support there, and the private sector can finance this. I don't need to slug taxpayers. Oh, okay. So then you get an extra raft of support. And at that point, you've got a steamroller. At that point, you've got a steamroller into a low-carbon economy happening.
Well, let's talk about that private sector, because there's big companies like Apple and Toyota that are issuing green bonds. And some governments are, like France and Poland. What's behind their interest in doing this?
For the governments, it's... It's part of their national climate change commitments. They're saying we want to make a mark to show that we're doing something, and we understand that bond markets need liquidity to get going. Bond markets typically require sovereign issuance to become viable, liquid, and to get the price down as a result. That's why the French did it. They said, we will be the liquidity creators in France, and they did a fantastic job. But they actually got a slight price benefit too because the demand was so strong. They went to market trying to do a bond for about 2.5 billion euros. And they got 21 billion euros of orders for this green bond they did, green sovereign. And they ended up closing at 7 billion euros. That's a pretty damn good deal for a sovereign. As I said, price benefit, new investors, a whole bunch of things like that. That's why they're doing it. But at the subnational level, like in New York Metropolitan Transit Authority or California State or Oregon and so on, or even the city of Lawrence in Kansas, who's issuing a green bond for green buildings, they're trying to let people know that they're actually making investments in climate change solutions, meeting their public sector priorities. They're trying to win new investors. So when Massachusetts, who were the first municipal issuer in the US, did their bond, they got flooded with inquiries from all around the US, including for the first time ever in their history, the huge TIA CREF fund, $10 billion social fund, bought Massachusetts Green Bond. They were cock-a-hoop because for them, broadening their base of investors makes it easy to issue bonds again and again and again. And they get a bit of price reduction as a result of having such a big group of investors too. They were so thrilled. And that's the story you're hearing from issuer after issuer after issuer. Retail bonds are coming now. So ordinary citizens like you and I this year will start being able to invest our savings, get a good return, and help save the planet. Keep an eye out.
Well, and I also hope that your prediction of a future that's as hot as a Thai chili pepper in August doesn't come true. But we hope these green bonds will help change the world and make it a cooler, safer place. Enjoy your dinner.
Thank you.
That's Sean Kidney, co-founder and CEO of the nonprofit Climate Bonds Initiative, and serves as a member of the European Commission's high-level expert group on sustainable finance. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of Green Sense. Send any comments or suggestions or ideas to robert@greensenseshow.com. We'll be back next week with...
You know, China is launching floating nuclear power plants. Is that a disaster waiting to happen, or is it actually a smart way to generate power? We'll find out from the Union of Concerned Scientists.
And you can hear about all our shows when you subscribe to the Green Sense Radio podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play by visiting greensensefarms.com. You can also view the list of radio stations that air our show if you want to listen the old-fashioned way. Don't forget to contribute to our pledge drive. We need your help to maintain our independent voice and bring you informative and entertaining programming so that you can make informed decisions. Stay fresh. Keep innovating, because when you're green, you grow.
GreenSense is recorded in the Duneland ecosystem on the eastern shores of Lake Michigan at GreenSense Farms, the largest indoor commercial vertical farm in the world. We walk the walk and talk the talk, growing leafy green vegetables 24/7, free of pesticides, herbicides, with non-GMO seeds, conserving resources, and reducing waste. Watch us grow. The program is copyright GreenSense Farms, all rights reserved.